Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What gives meaning to human existence? Colette Livermore believed she had found the answer at 17 when she saw a documentary about the Venerable Mother Teresa, who had founded an order of Catholic sisters devoted to serving God by caring for the poor. Livermore expected she would make sacrifices for the sake of her faith, but her years as a missionary of charity were difficult for reasons far beyond the deprivations that came with her vow of poverty. Over time, she renounced her vows, quit the church, and ultimately created an independent life of service that she feels gives her more power to relieve human suffering. Colette Livermore's memoir is called Hope Endures, Leaving Mother Teresa, Losing Faith, and Searching for Meaning. Colette, welcome to Think.
Good morning. Thank you, Chris.
You call yourself an accidental nun. You did not spend your entire childhood dreaming of that path for yourself. Can you talk about how your mind was made up?
Well, I was very much engaged in current affairs, and the sisters that taught me, the Dominicans, got us to think about the outside world, the Vietnam War, things like that. And there was a terrible famine in Biafra as I was growing up, and I decided to become a doctor and try and engage with the world that way. And I saw the documentary of Malcolm Muggeridge, Something Beautiful for God, and I saw sort of the immediacy of Mother Teresa's compassion. And I thought, well, people have very simple needs. They just need food and shelter, those sort of things. So there's really no need for me to go off and study for many years to become a doctor, that if I just joined Mother Teresa, I'd be able to immediately help these people. So that's the way I was thinking at 17.
And your family was not initially thrilled by that decision, which, of course, is often the best way to make a teenager really commit to something.
That's right. I thought it was a bit ironic that I expressed my teenage rebellion by submitting myself to a very strict regime of discipline and that sort of thing.
You put yourself in the convent, yeah.
Yeah, I'm going. I used to go around singing animal song, It's My Life and I'll Do What I Want. It's my mind and I think what I want, you know. So, that was unfortunately the way I became stubborn and decided I would go.
What did you know, Colette, about what would be expected of you as a missionary of charity before you entered?
Well, I suppose I understood very little. I knew that it was a life of poverty and service, but I didn't quite understand the religious aspect of it. We were with nuns but in our school, but they had been influenced by the Vatican II decisions. They were becoming more modern. They changed their habit. And they were always very engaged with the world, with current affairs and with reading and knowledge and that sort of thing. So I didn't expect the strict censorship and the cutting off from my family and friends. And the thing that I found most difficult, the obedience.
Yeah, you got there and it became clear instantly that this was not a place of joy. No talking, no choice of what you'd be allowed to eat or drink. You were even forced every afternoon to take a nap.
That's right.
That must have been huge to adjust to that from a relatively free life.
Well, yes, you couldn't go for a walk. You couldn't have friends. You couldn't ring up your mother. You couldn't listen to the radio or TV. But I suppose I was quite young and very idealistic, and I was willing to give up everything. I really had decided that I would follow Mother Teresa, and I just took it all in my stride to start with. I didn't find the physical things as difficult, but the intellectual and psychological sort of things, such as just that total lack of freedom, just to, if things were getting to you, just to walk out the door and go for a walk for a while, or access to music and things like that. Those are the things that I found hardest.
Yeah, and you were required to be totally dependent for everything. So if you tore your clothes, you had to ask, once a week you had a venue in which you could ask if you might have a patch to repair your clothing.
Yes, that's right. You had a garment book that you requested things that you needed, like a patch for your clothes or a new pair of sandals or something like that, but you could only request them when you'd thoroughly repaired everything and they were just beyond repair.
How did that total dependence affect your dedication to the order? Was it effective in sort of making you really feel part of this group?
I suppose so. I suppose it. I accepted it as a way of joining with the poverty that Mother Teresa thought was an ideal. And the thing that I found very hard was begging in the markets.
You had to beg for food.
We had to beg for food at the Victoria markets in Melbourne. And in Australia, that's very much frowned upon. And they have this insult called bludger, your bludger. And that means, you know, a person that doesn't pull their own weight, doesn't...
like a parasite, basically.
Parasite, mm-hmm. Yeah. And, yes, I found that extraordinarily difficult because, you know, our family had been fairly poor, but we'd always worked for our living, and I'd always worked since I was about 13, you know, in odd jobs and things. So I found that particularly difficult, that I felt very ashamed of begging.
Mm-hmm. And how... The order had money, is that right? People would give money and all that, but there was a sense that money shouldn't be spent for things like food.
Well, I mean, it was spent. Like, if we needed to buy things, we did. But I think Mother's idea was that we were to depend on divine providence. We were to have that insecurity and that God would provide for us. And so... As a young sister, I didn't know what our financial situation was. I just knew that Mother Teresa expected us to depend on God for everything. And so we had co-workers, we had people donating things to us, and we ourselves had to be very careful of how much money we spent. And with regard to the work, sometimes that reluctance to spend money became a problem, but From the sister's point of view, I think Mother wanted us to use as little of the donations as possible on ourselves.
Colette Livermore is my guest. Her new memoir is called Hope Endures, Leaving Mother Teresa, Losing Faith, and Searching for Meaning. What was the organizational structure of the order at the time that you were there?
Well, Mother Teresa was in charge of the order, and she was based in Calcutta, but she visited all the houses around the world. And then she had... counsellors in Calcutta that advised her. I think there were five or six, and they were elected by the sisters. And then she had regional superiors, so there'd be a superior for America, Europe, Asia, Africa, I assume. I can't remember exactly how the regionals were divided up, and I think it changes over time as the number of houses increases. And then you had the local superiors.
And there were times when it seemed that following the rules of that organization and of that structure were much more important, and the rules were much more valued than actually the spirit of what your work was supposed to be. You were sanctioned once for getting home late after stopping to help a man that you thought might be dying.
Oh, yes. That was the core problem for me. Mother Teresa felt that obedience was the path to holiness. And to me, obedience could be... an expression of cowardice. I agreed that you had to have obedience for cohesion within the organization, but sometimes obedience was an expression of subservience. And Mother Teresa asked for total surrender. She asked for obedience to the superiors. She said we expressed our fourth vow of wholehearted and free service to the poor under obedience. And so this was the main crucial conflict for me, that the demands of the timetable on many occasions, or the demands of the superior, conflicted with the immediacy of the needs of the people. So you'd have someone in front of you who was sort of on the street or coming to your gate, and because it was the wrong day or the wrong time, or just because the superior thought it wasn't appropriate, you are asked to not attend to that person or to send them away. And the whole thrust of our spiritual life, of the ideal of our society, was to administer to Christ in the distressing disguise of the poor. So it threw a person into total turmoil when you were asked not to respond to the person in this way. And that was the main source of conflict for me.
Did you sense that some of your peers actually found comfort in that abdication of responsibility? As long as you're listening to what Mother Superior says, you are not really held accountable for anything else.
Well, see, I think that was the danger, that the sister becomes infantilized in a way, that you're not treated as an adult who has their own ideas and responsibilities. And that, I think, is a very crucial problem with a lot of religions and a lot of organizations, that the person isn't treated as an adult, isn't educated as an adult, isn't listened to as an adult. They are kept in a childlike state, and I don't think any adult can abdicate their conscience and their internal responsibility and their responsibility to grow in knowledge and to bring all that's human to the task that they're meant to do. And so a lot of my difficulties surrounded this sort of concept, that we didn't study and learn. We weren't trained to do tasks that were assigned to us. We weren't asked for our opinion. In fact, I was always in trouble for being too free with my opinions and suggestions and such. So this was one of the difficulties of the organization.
Even to the extent that you were discouraged from getting any kind of medical training when you were working with people who were ill, because there was a sense that they didn't want sort of outsiders who were, I guess, hubristic with the knowledge that they received with medical education to take over the hospital.
Well, we had very simple hospitals, and when I was sent from New Guinea to Manila, I worked in the home there in Manila, and there was a lot of young men with tuberculosis, very ill and having a lot of trouble breathing and thin. And although I was interested in medicine at high school, I'd had no medical training at all. I didn't have a thorough knowledge of tuberculosis or of many of the diseases that people presented with there. And although I didn't expect to be trained as a doctor, although there were a couple of sisters in the order that were doctors, but even sort of a basic barefoot doctor sort of course, so that I knew what we were dealing with, the side effects of the drugs that we were giving, that sort of very basic knowledge was what I thought that we needed. But Mother Teresa believed that God uses the ignorant and the weak to confound the people that were knowledgeable and strong. And she did send some people for training, and she herself got a little bit of medical training in Patna before she started her work. But for us, as we were moved around the world, as individuals, we were often not very much prepared for what we were asked to do. And I think Mother Teresa felt that God would provide in us what was lacking, but we didn't take the normal human means to prepare ourselves for various things. And this was not just with regard to medicine, but with regard to teaching and language, our own health, that sort of thing.
Colette Livermore is my guest. Her new memoir is called Hope Endures, Leaving Mother Teresa, Losing Faith, and Searching for Meaning. After the break, we will talk about the experiences Colette herself had with Mother Teresa, and we will take your calls and emails. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is memoirist Colette Livermore. Today, she is an MD living in Australia. Her book is called Hope Endures, Leaving Mother Teresa, Losing Faith, and Searching for Meaning. If you want to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, as you mentioned earlier, Colette, Mother Teresa was based in Calcutta, but did travel around the world and visit the sisters in different areas. And you write that everyone had a sort of hero worship sense of her.
Yes, she was very much admired both within the order and in the society as a whole.
And she would, you describe her in some ways as sort of a micromanager.
Yes, she was a very dynamic woman, and she was a very charismatic and inspiring person as well. She had at that time we thought had a deep faith. I mean, she did have a deep faith, but she was a person that had a lot of internal darkness and doubts, which we found out later. But when you looked at her, she was someone of total conviction, full of energy, full of her ideal of serving Christ in the poor, but she was a bit of a micromanager. She'd come in and, you know, she would say, "This is not our way, sister," and she would, you know, if there was something that she didn't like, she would ask that that be removed from the house, or she'd move the house around, or things like that.
Did she have a sense of humor?
Yeah, she did. Mm-hmm. It wasn't all bleakness and everything. We'd go on outings sometimes as a community. There'd be a lot of singing, and there'd be sometimes plays in the evening for people's particular feast days. And so it wasn't a totally bleak existence or anything. There was a lot of happiness and joy in the sisters. But sometimes that was, Mother Teresa said that her cheerfulness and her outward joy was a cloak to hide her inner suffering and misery. So it wasn't always as it appeared.
I have to ask, how you took the revelations after Mother Teresa's death, that she spent essentially half a century, the very end of her life, not necessarily feeling the presence of God and not even confident that there was a God.
Well, this is a sort of bone of contention, isn't it? It's Mother Teresa's darkness is conceived as the dark night of the soul, where she spoke of this terrible pain of loss, of God not being God, of God not really existing. And she said there were all these questions within her, but she was afraid to ask them because of the blasphemy. And she once prayed, "If there be a God, forgive me." And she felt heaven was a total nothingness. And she wrote to her spiritual advisors, "I think all this turmoil within me will unbalance me." This is a totally different Mother Teresa to the very certain, dynamic sort of Mother Teresa that we encountered. And I tried to leave the order before my final vows, and I spoke to Mother Teresa in Calcutta, and she expressed no doubt at all. And I think when she said that to me, she must have been conceiving of these thoughts as temptations, and so not as true doubts, and certainly nothing she'd revealed to a junior sister. But I felt very elated when I read them. I don't understand my reaction, but I felt elated because it showed that she was having the same sort of struggles and that everything wasn't as it appeared, so certain and clear.
Do you have a sense that the regimentation of the order perhaps reflected her inability to even let doubt into the room?
Yes, I think so. Mother Teresa had a different form of spirituality to me and perhaps to many of us who joined. And it was sort of the 1930s type of spirituality, which was probably a reaction to the modernist heresy in the church, where the church felt under threat from rational and scientific thought. And so it felt that the best way to handle this was to batten down the hatches and to say that the way to holiness was through obedience and that you needed to submit the intellect to the church. And there was also a big emphasis on suffering within Mother Teresa's spirituality. And she talked about being victims of God's love and of quenching the thirst of Christ for souls and these sort of phrases, which I found very hard to understand. And so the whole drift of her spirituality was quite different, and it definitely was a censorious sort of spirituality where we could only read approved spiritual reading books or conservative spiritual reading books, and we couldn't read secular literature of any sort or newspapers or anything that would unbalance our faith or our vocation. But to me, this is part of the treating us as children, that therefore our faith and our conviction never matured or developed. And I think that truth can defend itself in open court. You don't need to coddle a person and cut them off from general knowledge and literature in order to keep them strong. In fact, I think that weakens a person, that they're not able to engage in the world, they're not able to know really what's going on in society, and I don't know how a person can live a mature adult life without that knowledge and without growing in knowledge. So this was a problem for me.
Let's talk for a minute about this concept of dark night of the soul, because this is sort of part of Catholic teachings, that the people who are exceptionally holy might go through these periods in their lives where they do face what feels like a total sort of doubt.
That's right. I think it originated with St. John of the Cross, and he has several different dark nights in his spiritual concept. But to me, it's a bit of a hard thing to understand, that the idea is that as a person is getting closer to God, they're put through a trial so that they're seeking God not for the consolations that God provides, but for God himself. Now, and so God withdraws all consolation, all joy in serving him, and just wants this person to go towards him in pure faith in this dark night. And that dark night is meant to purify the seeker and remove from them all that is not God. I've had trouble with that concept. I think in human terms, but which of course some people would say irrelevant, but if you had a friend who decided not to speak to you for 20 years just so that the friend could test the friendship, you know, we'd all have a bit of a worry with that. But I don't know how you distinguish true doubt and true questioning from this dark night, but in the theology it is, if you remain faithful, if you remain obedient, if you don't allow these temptations of doubt against the faith to enter your mind, you don't engage with them, then you're still a person of faith. And I think that was the path that Mother took. She obeyed her confessors. She blocked out any thoughts that would bring doubt into her mind, and she just continued trying to believe what she had been taught.
It is a fascinating dichotomy, the idea that she had, on the one hand, really no faith left, and on the other hand, she required herself to stay faithful to the things that she had believed at one time that inspired her to do what she did.
Well, she was working from this dark night of the soul paradigm. And in one way, it's a seductive sort of thought, because you feel that you're going through this trial, that you're getting closer to God, and so you just continue along. You feel that it's a trial, a temptation, something that, you know, you'll come through on the other side. So I think that's the way she was looking upon it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Colette Livermore is my guest. Her new book is called Hope Endures, Leaving Mother Teresa, Losing Faith, and Searching for Meaning. David in Plano writes, I read that this whole experience has led you to agnosticism. Was this a conscious choice on your part, or did it have more to do with not being able to find another faith that was more to your liking?
You'd like me to answer that?
This is David's email. Yes, if you can.
Yes. I lost my faith after more than 20 years after I left Mother Teresa, and I think it's very hard to explain succinctly how you lose something that you've based your life on, that's been up to now at the core of your being and the foundation of your life. But I didn't do it lightly. There were many reasons, but I think it was because things just didn't quite make sense, that the realities of life really didn't, they seemed to conflict with what was taught in most beliefs. And although I respect all religions and I follow many of the Christian ideals and still very much like some of the parables, like the Good Samaritan or the poor person sitting at the gate of the wealthy house owner, which I think is symbolic of our world, I can't really believe in a personal God that is involved in each person's life. And I just find some of the God of the sparrows of the gospel, the God of the lily of the fields, I find that hard to reconcile with the hundreds of thousands of people washed out to sea like debris in the Asian tsunami, or the many starving children in the world. I think the problem of evil and suffering in the world is one that religions have struggled with for a long time. So I'm not a Pollyanna sort of person. I'm not saying that if the world was perfect, then I'd believe in God. I'm just saying that many of the Christian teachings, for example, that sin and death came into the world because of... that suffering and death came into the world because of sin. Well, when you have a scientific view of the world, you know that suffering was always in the natural order and death was always in the natural order, even before human beings were here, and we just joined the natural order. So it's hard to explain, as I said succinctly, but I just found that my faith receded and it was just a change within me, like a change that I almost had no control over. I just couldn't believe anymore that we were all going to live in heaven. I didn't think that there is life after this life.
I'm wondering if you can remember the time before you lost your faith, if you projected forward and thought to yourself, well, if I couldn't believe in God fully, my life would be this or that. It would be horrible. I wouldn't have any hope. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, I did reach a point. I was in Catherine in the Northern Territory, and I felt that I would be lost if God was not. God is I am, and I started to think, is it possible that I am is not? And I felt that it'd be hard to forgive what was unforgivable. It would be hard to have hope. It would be hard to have strength to face different things, because when you are a believer, you feel that you can do all things in God who strengthens you. And when you're faced with suffering and death, you feel that, well, there will be some recompense for this person being tortured by cancer or this dying child, because they will have a life after this life and things will be evened up. Or if, for example, Aboriginal people who have lost their hope and are despairing and committing suicide because of their despair, they will be in another life, they will have joy. And it gives you a reason to go on. And also, I mean, it gives you an idea that there will be ultimate justice. But after losing your faith, you have to deal with the world in a much more practical way, that if it doesn't make sense in terms of this world, it doesn't make sense at all. And that you yourself have to give hope to people that don't have hope, and you yourself have to try and respond to the hungry rather than praying for God to do it.
I wonder how much that still sounds to you like the way Mother Teresa ultimately lived her life, that entire philosophy.
That she was supported by God.
Well, that she found it within herself to be taking on these actions, or found other people to do these things, to do the work of God, essentially.
Well, I think she felt God was using her as an instrument, and if she obeyed, the power of God would pass through her. She asked that we empty ourselves of all that's not God, so that God can use us. And that's she was basically often told me that I was too full of myself. Because I was so full of myself, God couldn't use me. And so this was her idea. But I think she She emptied herself of all that was human, and she felt depleted. And I think if you dishonor what is human, you can drift towards inhumanity. Even though she was a person of compassion and idealism, I think if you have the wrong beliefs and the wrong thoughts, you can come to the wrong conclusion. If you're on the wrong road, you can end up lost.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak to Daniel in Dallas. Hi, Daniel.
Yes, good afternoon.
Hi, go ahead, please.
I just wanted to comment quickly. I come from an Islamic perspective, perhaps. And I just wanted to comment on what you were saying before about the dark night of the soul being a Catholic concept. I believe that is also not only an Islamic, Catholic, Christian concept, but it's a stage which is universal to any seeker who's trying to find himself or herself. It is perhaps a concept that's difficult or almost impossible to describe or put in words. But I think the beauty of all that for any human being, being Muslim or being of any faith, any man or person or any man or woman who does have goodwill, who does have good intention, even through going through all the dark nights and dark hours, which it may be manifest in many different ways, I think if that person continues doing his or her actions in a positive way to benefit humanity, that's the beauty of all this.
Daniel, thanks so much for your call.
Thanks.
My guest this hour is Colette Livermore. Her new memoir is called Hope Endures, Leaving Mother Teresa, Losing Faith, and Searching for Meaning. We'll return to our discussion in a moment. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or via email that goes to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Colette Livermore. Her new memoir is called Hope Endures, Leaving Mother Teresa, Losing Faith, and Searching for Meaning. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. Colette, when you finally decided that you wanted to leave the order, and I guess you had thought about this for some time before it actually happened, what were you most excited about?
Well, I suppose the freedom to act the way that I thought I should act. And Chris, I'd just like to comment on what Daniel said, and that to me was the essence of why I wrote the book and why I left the order, that you do have to have that freedom in any darkness to act the way you think is right and to obey that inner core of yourself. And it was because I thought that was being denied me that I was in a sort of culture of obedience, and you start to think like that culture, and that can take away your freedom to act the way that you think is the best way to act. And I think that's a real danger, that you can't be who you are and you can't behave the way you are. And I think Steven Weinberg said that good people do good and evil people do evil, but sometimes under the influence of religion or under some other sort of ideology, good people do evil. And I think that inner freedom is essential to preserve, and the inner freedom to respond the way you want to. And so when I left the order, that I could just behave the way I wanted to, that I could go for a walk and I could, you know, react to people in the way that I thought was the best way to react.
Do you think ultimately that lack of freedom contributed to your loss of faith? In other words, if your most formative years had been spent in a place where you were able to explore your own values and morality as opposed to having them thrown upon you, thrust upon you, do you think you'd find it easier today, perhaps, to believe in God?
I don't think so, because I believed in God for 20 years after I left the order, and I thought about it a lot, and I read a lot, and I came to this conclusion after a fair bit of struggle. So I don't think it was a false concept of God that caused me to lose my belief. I think I'd gone into it fairly thoroughly by the time my faith seemed to recede.
Did you worry that it would be a blow to your mother to let her know that you didn't believe in God anymore?
Well, my mother probably didn't know that I didn't believe in God because she started to get Alzheimer's disease, mm-hmm. and I came back from East Timor to be with her in her final years, and you know, I'd still take her to Mass and I'd still be with her in church and things like that, even though I couldn't believe myself. And I actually prepared her funeral Mass for her and chose all the readings and the songs, and I still wouldn't take away from her or anything what gave her comfort and what helped her in her last days. But I don't know if she ever actually understood that I didn't believe in God anymore.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Jay Bean in Carrollton. Hi, Jay Bean.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two things I would like to share with your guests. One is Tom Brokaw, near the end of Mother Teresa's life, shared a dream that she had that occurred over and over. In the dream, Mother Teresa died and went to heaven, and St. Peter met her, and he said, "Mother Teresa, we don't have any slums in heaven." And that was all of the dream. And I thought I knew the interpretation, but it was a long, long time before the Lord revealed it to me, when he had a time for me to use it in my life. And my interpretation is she was not sharing the gospel with the people she was helping.
Well, thank you very much for your call, Jay Bean.
Okay, and there's one other thing.
We have people on the line. I'm so sorry. Thank you so much for calling, but we have lots of people waiting to also speak. I wonder if, Colette, you can talk about you were, when you were ministering to people, how much at the time when you were still a sister, how much emphasis was placed on spreading religious values as opposed to just sort of physical comforts?
Well, I mostly worked in sort of responding to the physical needs of people. I wasn't much involved in teaching of catechism, but some of the sisters definitely were, that especially we'd go into Catholic schools or we'd go into schools and teach catechism to the Catholics there. We weren't very much encouraged to proselytize or to change people's beliefs, if that was what the questioner was asking. This may have been the case in some situations, but in general, we were to preach the gospel with our life. That was what Mother Teresa encouraged us, that we were to take Christ into the homes of the poor by our smile, by our kindness, but not necessarily by our words.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Jennifer in Louisville. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
I'm surprised I got on.
Welcome.
I'm really excited to hear this. My question was really deep, and I hope I'm not offensive, but as a follower, as a follower of Christ, I really sometimes, seem to think that, we get bogged down by seeing other people fail. And it makes us go, wow, you keep wondering, is this ever going to end? All these bad things that happen, all these bad things that people are doing. And my question is, you know, there's only one person that we knew, or at least we, if you have faith, was Christ. And my question was, how is it that you lost sight of that whole process that he died for you because everybody else was a mess? You know.
Thanks, Jennifer. Thanks for your call. Maybe you can speak a little bit more, Colette, about your the process that you went through. Because as you mentioned, it was 20 years after you left the order that you decided that you no longer believed.
Well, my take on the death of Christ was that he was a radically good and honest man, and people killed him because of that very fact. That I didn't feel that Christ was killed for our sins. I can't understand a God that would kill his son as retribution for the sins of other people. I just felt that it was the radical goodness of Christ that led to his death. And if Christ died an innocent and good man, and if there was no resurrection, this is where the whole problem is for the that evil, that barbarism, that war and that sort of thing can ultimately have the upper hand. And it's not that I was disillusioned. I didn't think that Mother Teresa was a bad person. I didn't think she failed. I think she did everything she could to follow God as she saw God. She was a very generous and courageous person. But I felt that her underlying spirituality was in some way faulty, or that led her to this path of suffering and sort of denying what was human in a way. So I didn't lose my faith because of pedophilia in the church or because I felt people had failed. I lost it because I just couldn't reconcile it to my experience of life. And I still have admiration for the teachings of Christ, but I find it hard to adhere to that whole concept of salvation, that somehow Christ died for my sins. And as I said, I just think that if a person is as truthful as they can be, that they will run into problems in life and have enemies.
You went to Rome 5 years ago to attend the beatification ceremony for Mother Teresa.
Yes.
What was your emotion as you saw the outpouring of love and respect and in some ways hero worship that so many thousands and millions of people had for her?
Well, I felt confusion and I felt conflicted because I was happy for her. I was happy for her life to be acknowledged and her belief that the sacred and the holy is in each person, especially the marginalized. But I felt that this is not the only story, that there's a deep paradox at the heart of Mother Teresa. And this concept, this turmoil and difficulty that I had, I thought I need to speak because this is not the whole story. And a lot of sisters who have left the order have this sort of confusion. You know, they wanted to follow this person, this living saint, the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize. They wanted to give everything they had, and it ended up, you know, in a very dark place. It ended up in disillusionment. And I thought that we need to explore why this happens so that other people won't fall into this very dark place. And another thing that upset me was that some sisters have become angry under this system. When you're corrected, you're not allowed to justify yourself. You know, people can be spoken to quite harshly. Their sinfulness is emphasized, and they can't speak if they move from one place to the other for unjust reasons, for example. I think that this has made some sisters quite angry, and it's a terrible thing to happen, that a person who's given their life so generously becomes angry because of the system under which they live. And so that's why I thought, before Mother Teresa is canonized, this sort of the things deep within her organization maybe need to be questioned.
What do you she really discouraged you from leaving the order. Can you talk about that a little bit?
yes, she felt that I was being deceived by the devil, and that the devil, who was the father of lies, was telling me that this is a good way. He was bringing me, he was teaching me to lead the order as a false light, you know, and that I was trying to do something good, but she in fact thought I was betraying my vocation to be a missionary of charity. So she three times sent me a picture of crucified Christ, crowned with thorns, not crucified, but the scourged Christ, crowned with thorns. And she sent it to me on three occasions and wrote at the bottom, be the one. In fact, like, accept the suffering, accept the turmoil. She said, come back home and I'll send you to Africa. Because she knew that I wanted, I joined to serve the poor in Biafra. And so she understood that I really wanted to live in a poorer part of the world and respond to people suffering there. So she asked me to come back and she'd send me to Africa because there was another famine on in Africa. But once I'd left, I wasn't ever able to go back and submit again to that sort of intellectual and sort of the suppression that I felt within the order.
Is there anything that you miss about that time in your life?
That I miss?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I miss the comradeship with the sisters, and I miss being able to live with the poor or have a lot of contact with them. I made friends within the order, even though that was frowned upon, you know. And I suppose I miss the ideal. I miss the certainty of faith and the consolation of faith that that this life is not all that there is, that there's other things that give meaning to life. But I've started, that's why my book's called Hope Endures, that I think hope endures in friendship, in learning, in new experiences, in many other ways. That, and I think that as long as you're true to what is truthful in your life, you can still have hope. You don't have to cocoon yourself off from reality to have that.
Colette Livermore's memoir is called Hope Endures, Leaving Mother Teresa, Losing Faith, and Searching for Meaning. Colette, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you to your listeners.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.